Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with the guy who is personifying that mantra of once a Marine, always a Marine. At nearly 96 years old, Jim McCrory of Porterville, California has an amazing memory and an incredible story to tell. We'll hear what he experienced on Guadalcanal, but when we left off, he was 26 miles away from there on the tiny island of Gavutu, right next to its twin, Tanambogo. Two places you've probably never heard of, and as we're about to hear, two places where Jim came oh so close to giving his life for our country.
We secured Gavutu, and then I was ordered up on top of the hill. There was Hill 150 and 149. And the reason is because they were 150 and 149 foot tall. That's the designation. But anyhow, we were going to assault Tanambogo, and they wanted all automatic weapons on top of this hill to fire over on Tanambogo, which was about 400 yards away and connected with what they called the causeway, which was a road that had been coral dredged up and piled up and made a road between the two.
So, again, these two islands are both in the harbor.
Right.
They're connected inside by the harbor. Little causeway.
Connected by this little
causeway. So you're firing from a high point over on Gavutu over to Tanambogo.
Right. And it was so far that my tracers were actually burning out before they got there. I couldn't aim or anything, but I could do like a garden hose. I could watch my tracers and tell where my bullets were going. So anyhow, I was up there for a few minutes firing, and there was people like me, and there had been a Jap observation point up there where they had dug a pit about 8 by 8 and built a roof over it. And unknown to us, there was a Japanese flag on top of that roof. And there was a squadron of SBDs from the Enterprise bombing Tanambogo, just circling around and wanted to peel off and bomb and come up. And this guy, I looked up, and I saw him point right at me. And I saw that 500-pound bomb detached from his airplane. So instead of getting up and running, he was probably 1,200 foot high or something. I just got on my hands and knees, and I went backwards as fast as I could go down that hill. And before the bomb went off, I must have got maybe this much of the curve of the hill between me and the bomb. And it went off, and everything turned black. And I thought, I remember so clearly my thinking. I thought, well, I'm dead. Then it turned gray. I thought, well, I'm not dead. And I looked up, and I could see 2x4 and pieces of tin and stuff circling in the air. And I thought, well, those will kill me when they come down. But they didn't, except that I was stone deaf. Mm. However, that bomb lit right on top of the roof of that building. We had two complete sets of air-cooled 30 caliber Browning machine guns with their crews in there. And those people, we didn't find bodies. They were gone, just totally vanished. And then there were several other men wounded, but I was not. As I say, I just had this shock, this deafness and concussion. And 500-pound bomb is this big around and that high, you know. They're not a little bitty thing.
Very destructive.
They'll sink a ship.
And so everybody listening understands here. So you had taken this position.
Yes.
Not knowing that above you is flying a Japanese flag.
No, I did not know that. So, nor did anyone else, or we'd have got it down.
You couldn't see it from where you were
coming. No, it was on. There was a corrugated metal roof over this observation point, and this flag was flat on this corrugated iron roof.
How did you guys find out about the flag?
Because somebody found it later. It didn't totally destroy.
Ah, they found it in the rubble.
Found it in the rubble.
So
still on some of the metal.
So no one can fault this SBD dive bomber pilot for seeing a Japanese flag and
we did not fault him, even though, you know, it's called friendly fire.
Yep.
We did not fault the man. But the instant that happened, they all vanished in a flash because I'm sure the others were saying, hey, 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 the ones who knew, but we did not fault him.
The story you're telling really underscores how a real minute detail can have a huge life or death impact on people.
Correct.
No one had any idea that flag's up there.
Had no idea.
And you say those bodies were disintegrated.
They were gone.
How many people you think were killed?
In that little group were 8, and there were probably 3 more killed up and down the top of that little hill. Then there were a lot who were like me, you know, were shocked or deafened or whatever. In fact, this friend of mine who maybe the rest of the time there was never more than 3 or 4 foot from me, when these people were killed, this is horrible. I'll tell you some horrible things, make you sick. Blood flu. There's a lot of blood in 8 or 10 people. And this friend of mine was drenched in this blood. He was as shocked as I was, and he got a few splinters of shrapnel in his arms, but he wasn't really injured. And when the corpsman came up there, they saw him all bloody, and they asked him, you know, what's wrong with you? And he said, I'm okay, you know. But they thought he was out of his mind from the bomb, so they forced him onto a stretcher and took him down to the aid station where they cleaned him up, and they found out there was nothing wrong with him. Then they chewed his for having used 4 stretcher bearers and taking up the doctor's time and stuff.
Even though he told him he was
fine. Even though he kept trying to tell him he was okay. But would you believe a man drenched in blood or if a bomb had detonated maybe 30 foot from his head was okay?
Well, and how far were you from where it detonated?
Probably 25, 30 foot.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but my interpretation of what you've shared with me is that by any reasonable expectation, you should not have survived that.
I should not, no. No, it was by the grace of God, by scooting backwards on my hands and knees, I probably got that much of the curve of the mountain between me and the bomb.
Yeah, and like if you a foot get, or so. Uh-huh.
Yeah, if you get that much, it will throw the impact up. Or if I hadn't have had that, I would have disintegrated like the rest of them.
You had about a foot of overhang that redirected
the shrapnel. I would estimate
that,
yes. Uh-huh. Because this all took place in seconds. When I looked up and I could see the bomb turn loose,
yeah.
You know, it's like somebody throws a rock at you. You know where it's going to hit? Well, I knew it was going to hit me.
Mm-hmm.
I could see it. So there was nothing I could do. I couldn't get up and run. I didn't have time. So that's where I said I scooted backwards. I only had seconds to do it, so I couldn't have got more than 25 or 30 foot down the mountain. So I'm only guessing.
So your life is spared.
Yes.
But you told us you couldn't hear anything.
Not for 2 or 3 days.
2 or 3 days. Mm-hmm. How did you communicate for those 2 or 3 days?
We just didn't.
Did you get any nicks or scratches or anything else from it?
I did not.
Nothing. Wow.
And the whole time on Guadalcanal and everywhere else, outside of this eye being damaged by the front sight of a Springfield rifle, I never got a scratch. However, there was fungus and stuff so bad that we all had terrible rotten spots that went clear to the bone on us. Mm-hmm. Ulcers. They were so, if you'd get a scratch on your leg, it would turn into an ulcer. I've still got dimples on my legs from
I don't want to dwell on, you know, this horrible stuff, but I just want to understand what it was like to be you. Again, you're 20 years old.
Yeah.
You just almost died. You can't hear a thing. You don't know if you're ever going to hear anything again. And a bunch of the guys that you had been there with just got vaporized by one of your own bombs.
Yes.
How do you handle that? How do you deal with that?
Some people can and some people can't. I happen to be one who could. However, not as well as I thought. If I had something to occupy me all the time, I could deal with it all my life. But my first wife was a schizophrenic, and taking care of her occupied me completely. But when I lost her, I began to get terrible attacks of PTSD because I was not totally occupied.
So when your mind has time to wander, that's where it goes.
When my mind has time to wander, it goes to all those dead faces looking at me and that sort of thing.
Wow.
Because we killed so many Japanese, and I don't know if it's my imagination or not, but it seemed to me like dead people die on their back looking at you. Because I still only remember these faces, and we killed literally, well, we killed 800 Japanese on that one island, and when we took Tanambogo, we killed 1,500 over there. And these were about the size of city blocks. So there were bodies actually in places stacked on each other, 3 deep or 4 deep.
And you're speaking in the present tense. This is not something that you're over your past. You know that you're still susceptible to these flashbacks and these bouts of PTSD.
Yes, I am. And this is a very worrisome thing for me about the young men of today, because I know that these young men who were in Iraq and there are not over that at all, just because they're out of there. It's going to be all their lives.
And you said some people can deal with it, some can't.
That's
and you
correct.
Could.
And I could.
What was that? What gave you that ability?
I have no idea. I can look at 5 people, or you could, or anybody, and not a one of us has the ability to look at one of them and say, that guy is tough, he can take it. You never know till you're in it.
And you were.
And I was.
Well, I just have to imagine then, too, that if you can't hear for 3 days, when you finally do start to hear some faint little whispers, that had to be a pretty good feeling.
It was. I was afraid that I'd be deaf for life. In fact, we had one corporal who was. Corporal Miller would never regain his hearing.
So this is the first time that your life is almost taken, but there's still a lot of work to do. You're going over to this neighboring island.
The plan to take the next island was that they would put a company of Marines, and I believe it was L Company, on the beach with two light tanks, and then that we would charge, believe this or not, 400 yards across this causeway right into a machine gun bunker. Again, I say that that's what courage is, I guess. It's being able to do what you're asked to do, no matter how frightened you are or how much you think, I'm not going to make it. And our platoon was ordered to make a bayonet charge right straight across this causeway into this bunker. So
and again,
we
this
did.
This is a narrow strip.
Probably 30 foot wide.
30 feet wide, water on either side.
Right.
So there's only one place you guys can be coming from.
Right, and one place to go.
And you're going straight at?
Going straight at it, and there's a bunker made out of 55-gallon gasoline drums filled with sand, and like four deep and three deep and two deep, and railroad ties over the top, and then whole thing covered with sand and machine guns in it.
But yet you're still here. So what happened?
They shot over my head.
And you said a bayonet charge.
Yeah, but of course I didn't have a bayonet. I had a BAR, but I kept up the best I could with all that weight. And we got over there. Somebody went in with I remember they took a Tommy and went in and killed the Japanese inside the bunker. And then we were still getting fire, and I looked up and I saw a flash, and there were a row of coconut palms along the beach. And the Japanese had tied men up in those palm trees. And, of course, my BAR is a light Browning machine gun, and it just shredded those coconut palms. They had them tied with a rope. You could see a body drop like that. So then I just automatically went the next and the next. And
once you saw that one tree had a sniper, you
tree,
figured they all did.
I figured they all did. And then, in the meantime, let me set you up with what was happening. They had brought a company of Marines ashore on a rather flat beach part of it, and they brought these two tanks, and between us and them was a slight rise that we couldn't see over, so we couldn't see what was happening. So we kept going, and we came up over that, and the Japanese were inside this mountain, and they had swarmed out, hundreds of them, and swarmed over these tanks, and they brought crowbars and stuff like that and jammed in the tank tracks, and one of the tanks had eyes centered on a coconut stump. And they got them stopped and poured gasoline on them and set them on fire. But two guys got out of one tank and ran over, and there was a powder room there. And they got in there and closed the door and hid out in that room. But anyhow, as we came over, here were these hundreds of Japanese on these tanks, and we began firing our machine guns, my BAR and stuff, into them. And then they panicked when they were out there being slaughtered like fish in a barrel, and tried to get back in the mountain, and the entrance to it was like a concrete pipe, maybe 40 inches round, but several hundred men can't get in that pipe at one time. So they panicked and ran for it, and they piled up against the entrance like they had on the tanks. So again, we killed them by the dozens and dozens there. And this is going to sound preposterous, but it's the absolute truth.
All right.
Around the tanks, say 30, 40 foot around the tanks, the bodies were piled up on top of each other from 2 to 3 foot high. Just bodies piled on each other. And out 50 to 60, 70 foot, they were touching each other. And then between there and to where we began killing them that way into the entrance to the mountain, again, they were bodies there, and then they were touching, and then they were piled on each other around the entrance. It's just unbelievable. They're just mountains of these bodies. And now the horrible deal starts. We killed everyone we could find. We killed them all. In fact, before we got off the ship, Americans wouldn't believe this, but this is what really happened. Our colonel came on the ship's intercom, and he said, "I don't know what's on that island, men," but he said, "when it's all over, I want everything dead except my Marines." Now, in real wartime, you're not supposed to say things like that, but that's what our colonel told us.
Well, and the explanation retroactively that I've heard so often is that Americans came to learn about Japanese forces that they were going to fight to the death no matter what.
But they didn't know it then.
That's what
they
I was going to ask you.
They only learned it from us.
Yeah.
You know, our corpsmen wore Red Crosses and didn't carry weapons for one day. And then they became targets with their Red Cross. So pretty quick their Red Crosses came off and a .45 came on their side. And from then on the Geneva Convention was no more. But our colonel said, "I want nothing left alive but my Marines."
Well, you knew what your marching orders were then.
Yes.
you said something about courage there. No matter how scared you are, knowing that this could be it, still charging ahead. How scared were you? Can you describe that?
Actually, I don't know that I was so frightened as I was just resigned. We kind of, in a short while, began to get the attitude that we're going to die. I'm just not dead yet. But why worry about it? Because I am dead. I'm not going to get out of this alive. So that's kind of the attitude we had. I'm dead. Why worry about it?
You never expected to come back.
I never expected to live through it.
So this whole story that you've been telling us, I think very few people are even aware that those two tiny little islands exist.
Yeah, they are.
And we've heard about, you know, Tarawa and a tiny strip of land with so many casualties. You said each of these islands is about a city block?
Yes, just not over a city block.
Yet you guys wiped out over 2,000 Japanese on those
2,300.
Wow. So once those two islands are secure, you're nowhere near home free. You have no idea how long you're going to be over in this part of the world.
And that's when we begin to starve, because the Japanese have total control of the ocean and the sky, and we have what food we came ashore with.
So, which you said was enough for 2 days.
And we were there 2 days. I mean, it was 2 days of fighting.
And you said it was 26 days before you got...
It was 26 days before a little, they called them APDs, World War I destroyers that had been modified, came slipping in one evening and throwed wooden boxes of food over the side. Never even stopped. He was afraid to stop and unload. Just kicked them over the side. But anyhow, there were a lot of palm trees on there. And I learned that top of palm trees is very edible and tastes about like cabbage. I ate a lot of that. I could go out on a reef and catch crabs.
You ate palm leaves?
I ate the top of the palm tree, to where the leaves are forming and coming out.
Uh-huh.
I ate that.
So it's still real green and
yes,
flexible? And you can bite it?
Yeah, it's like the cabbage core.
So you had to climb the palm tree to do
that? No, they were all blown down by shellfire.
Oh, you grabbed the ones that were on the ground. Okay.
Get the ones on the ground.
Okay.
I liked it. I like cabbage. Still do.
Uh-huh.
And the Japanese had a large thing that they stored rice in, and there was a lot of rice in it, including rat manure, which was the black rice, and the white rice was the edible. So we picked the black rice out and boiled the white. We ate that, and they left bales and bales of seaweed. They eat lots of seaweed.
So you found a way to survive.
I survived. And our main problem to start with was water. We had no water. And somebody found a little spring, a stream of water about as big as my thumb. They instantly got jerry cans over there and put an armed guard on it. And for a day or two, we just had a canteen of water per day.
There were so many factors threatening his survival, but Jim McCrory is still here at 95, almost 96. And he hasn't even taken us onto the island of Guadalcanal yet. He'll do that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.